me. Look, thank you so much, Peter, for that introduction. And can I say what a very great pleasure it is to be here tonight to talk about this most interesting topic. I just want to start my presentation with this short video clip, which very much sets the scene of some of the new developments in this discipline over the last 5 to 10 years.
Two archaeologists claim they've found the tomb of Jesus. The announcement comes with the release of their new book, The Jesus Discovery. The Philadelphia Inquirer reports, the work contends that two Jerusalem tombs beneath a condominium complex can be traced to Jesus of Nazareth, his family, or his followers. One tomb found in 2010 under a patio is directly connected to Jesus' first followers, those who knew him personally, and to Jesus according to the authors. The archaeologists used a robotic arm with a camera to look down into the tomb, where they found carvings on boxes containing bones, images they argue depict Jonah and the whale. Fox News has the photos.
The archaeological evidence, which, by the way, as you see right there, is written in stone, including the sign of Jonah, is, experts say, strikingly consistent with the text of the gospel.
Those bone boxes are also called ossuaries. CNN spoke with the archaeologists. They explain the image of Jonah and the whale is a resurrection image because Jesus said his resurrection would be like Jonah's.
This is the earliest Christian-related icon ever found. And next to it is a resurrection statement, the only resurrection statement ever found in an ossuary out of 3,000 ossuaries already found in Jerusalem.
As the news breaks, other archaeologists are analyzing the findings. MSNBC reports many are speaking out against the claims. The main objection to the claims for the Jesus family tomb, like the claims themselves, retraces ground that's been well trod since 2007. Just because bone boxes are marked with the name Jesus and the names of his brothers and sisters, as mentioned in the Bible, doesn't necessarily mean these are the actual biblical figures. The expedition is the subject of a Discovery Channel special set to air this spring. For Newsy, I'm Anna Campaign Romero. Multiple sources, the real story.
Need to get you to put the presentation. Well, that's a very, very interesting news story. And in fact, you may remember the documentary, which was on Discovery Channel or National Geographic or one of those a couple of years ago, which outlined these discoveries. And I think it's very illustrative of one of the new developments in archaeology and the Bible over the last 5 to 10 years. And that is that it is very much fueled, some of it is fueled by the content-hungry 24/7 media cycle. And as this particular story demonstrates, and the documentary itself, there is a branch of media-fueled sensational discoveries which find their way into the popular press. Now, for people who are Christian in this audience, and I'm a Christian as well, you'll find that this is real water cooler talk. When it hits the front page of the paper or is in the news like this. And we're often asked, what do we think? How are we to respond? What is it true? My rule of thumb about this sort of thing is always follow the money trail. So there were a number of key matters that were mentioned in this. This is just a brief summary of this discovery, by the way. There were two tombs, one of them known as the Jesus tomb because it featured a bone box with the name of Yeshua on it and some other names which people believed were the relatives of Jesus. Now, of course, finding a bone box with the name of Jesus on it is highly sensational because really what you're claiming is that Jesus didn't rise from the dead and that he's just buried with his family. But as you see, this was not a new discovery. As one also looks at the next tomb, the so-called Patio tomb in the Talpiot region of Jerusalem, again, a material that's been known for some time, picked up by really what could best be described as dilettantes. I hope I'm not being rude in using that term, but people really who weren't archaeologists, so the word archaeologist was used in the news story when in fact none of the people involved were dirt archaeologists. There was one scholar, a New Testament scholar from an American institution, who has a very polemical view of the historicity of the New Testament and of Jesus himself. So he was an interesting addition to that team and would unquestionably bring a form of skepticism to his interpretation of the data. But actually, it's interesting to note that this was in fact, although the tomb was excavated some time ago, it was re-examined. At least the Patio tomb was re-examined using a robotic camera. So this tomb is now underneath the Patio of a block of flats, and it was investigated through the drilling of a hole through the Patio of the apartment, which was sitting on top of this tomb, which had been discovered but in fact built over. The ossuaries and the contents of the ossuaries still in situ, as you see. There's a plan. You can see where the arm of the camera went into the tomb by way of those red lines. Robotic arm, which took pictures of these ossuaries and relayed them back in real time to people on a television camera above the or monitor rather above the tomb. But it's important to note that the people who wrote the book, did the documentary, got all this media, didn't actually handle the material themselves. They didn't excavate it themselves, and were really not even seeing it with their own eyes. Really, just very much through the lens of this robotic camera. And indeed, a range of findings were made. You can see here the photographs that were taken, and the conclusions drawn. Here is that interesting image representing Joni. You can see the bone box, the ossuary. Interestingly, in the news story, I thought this was quite funny. The news story actually showed this fish figure horizontal, when in fact, as you see, on the actual ossuary itself, it's vertical. So I don't know how they managed to get the idea of a fish from a vertically placed item on this bone box. But really, and here is the book that was released. In fact, there's been more than one book. There's been several books plus a television documentary. So really, what's happened in the last, particularly in the last 5 years, is that we are... there is this branch of archaeology which is divorced from a peer-reviewed, formal peer-reviewed institutional engagement and controls. These people deal directly with media outlets. There's a great pressure while filming a documentary to come up with the results in front of the camera. I know myself, I did a documentary for Discovery Channel back in the late 1990s, and the TV crew was constantly, the producer was constantly wanting to capture my reaction. He didn't want me to test anything with scholars beforehand. He wanted me to actually make my findings and reactions on camera as a way of capturing the story of my journey through discovering a story about some Egyptian mummies that I was involved with. But actually, this kind of archaeology has its pitfalls, and it is divorced from traditional modes of academic discussion. Scholars are often bypassed, but then are forced to engage with the findings through the public media. It was not necessarily equipped to do that, but here, there they are. These discoveries happen, and people are on the phone, radio stations, etc., on the phone saying, "What do you think?" I mean, I even had a call just this week from Richard Glover on 702, wanting to ask me about this new research that's been released about the moving of the pyramid stones. What did I think? Was it, you know, was it valid? Was it real? You know, what was my reaction? So it's a very interesting world that we're in nowadays. And it's a media-driven world for not just archaeology but many other scientific disciplines. And how, as academics, we engage with this is also interesting, how we not only engage but actually get our own research in the public square as well, I think is another question. And often we kind of trying to hit the KPIs of the department in terms of getting our publications published in peer-reviewed journals, but there is actually a role for us to play, I think, in actually engaging in the public square with our material in a way that, particularly if we're in that space of intersecting with the Bible, it's a very important part of how we actually engage in the public square. So that, I think, is a very... Just wanted to open with, I think this is a very important development that we have to grapple with as scientists and scholars, and it's one that's actually just not going to go away. And now we have, of course, the advent of social media and so forth, which intensifies that engagement. So it really is almost a case that hardly a month goes by without some new controversy, a media story, as I said, a documentary, etc., where some discovery proves or disproves the Bible. And these matters are really, as I said, the subject of very wide public comment. And I think it's fair to say that notwithstanding the 24/7 media cycle and social media, there's a sense in which this has always been true, so from the 19th century onwards, when objects and material from the Near East started to come into museums, into Europe and so forth, fantastic objects, discoveries from Mesopotamia, texts started to be translated, people could understand ancient texts. There was this intense public interest in what archaeology and what archaeology has to say about the Bible, except nowadays it's very much amplified by the mass media. So where do we stand in relation to the intersection of archaeology and the Bible? How are we to understand it? Is the science of archaeology so far removed from the Bible that there is little that can be said of the relationship within or between the two? And some would argue that, in fact, archaeology and the Bible are so far apart that never the twain shall meet. But I want to argue that, in fact, the position is somewhere in the middle. There is still a lot that we don't know about the past, which archaeology continues to illuminate. But we also need to acknowledge that there are gaps and dissonances in the scientific record in relation to the Bible. I think we just have to acknowledge that. But there is still a lot that we don't know. And indeed, as I said, one new discovery can really change things. One new discovery made tomorrow can really understand, it can really change the way we look at an aspect of the biblical narrative. In relation to the problems, there really are many. The conundrum, and a conundrum is an absence of evidence for the Hebrews in Egypt. That remains very problematic. In relation to having a clearer understanding of the Exodus account on the ground, that is a reality. I have to acknowledge that. Joshua's conquest of Jericho is difficult to establish at the site that we identify as Jericho. That's another, I was at Jericho recently. I went there with a group and back in March and got a look at some of the new archaeological work that's been taking place there under the Italians. And, there's no question that it is still a problematic site in terms of understanding where the Bible sits with the archaeological evidence. But in fact, what really struck me about Jericho was as I stood on the top of the site and looked at the new trenches, how much erosion has actually taken place on the ancient tell is very significant. When you're standing on the very top of the ancient Mount of Jericho, and you're staring into palatial buildings of the early Bronze Age, dating to the time of the Great Pyramids, sitting on the very literally, 40 centimetres below the surface of the top of the mound. I mean, that's so, there are things like this that need to be taken into account. And of course, the archaeology of Noah and the flood, look, let's face it, that's ground that very few people will even dare to tread. So I don't see matters as necessarily an either-or proposition. I see them as sometimes problematic propositions, but I think one needs to have a very clear understanding of both sources, so both the biblical sources and the archaeological sources, in their correct context. Importantly, there are severe limitations on archaeological inquiry. And of course, the Bible itself is an ancient document written over a long period of time by different people through a very different lens and perspective to ours. And so so bringing those two things together is not very easy. Now, I have to say that I'm not a theologian. I'm not theologically trained. My experience is in dirt archaeology. Absolutely right when Trevor said that I was pregnant, being led, dropped down a shaft and crawling into a tomb. I wasn't going to miss that for anything, particularly as we were the first people to enter this tomb in over 4,000 years. I wasn't going to let a pregnancy stop me from doing that. Although it was a little bit awkward when we're in this burial chamber, 12 metres below the ground, digging the deposits. The chamber was no bigger than a bathroom, a small bathroom, and the Egyptian workmen that were with me were all busy smoking cigarettes, and there's no ventilation. I was thinking, oh, I don't know that this is such a good idea. But anyway, it was a very exciting thing, and it's terrific to actually be part of that. I love the process of discovery and putting the evidence together, trying to nut out the story, working out where the gaps in the evidence are, and trying to understand the past through the lens of archaeological evidence. So I love doing that, but I need to say up front that I'm not a theologian. So, but as I've thought of, as a Christian, as I've thought about this question and thought about the intersection of archaeology and the Bible, I've landed on a couple of key phrases which I hope that you'll find helpful, and really I think for me puts things into some sort of framework. And I think Professor Alan Millard, very famous scholar from the University of Liverpool, has, I think, for me, encapsulated this phrase, this relationship very well, that the service of archaeology is mainly to provide the stage props for the scriptures, which is the Bible. The service of archaeology is mainly to provide the stage props for the script, which is the Bible. Now, I think it's a little bit more complex than that. This statement was written some years ago. But what I want to do is step through a number of matters which I think you'll find helpful as you understand what archaeological evidence can and cannot achieve. And secondly, I am going to talk a little bit about some of the issues, some of these disconnects and highly polemical debates that are happening at the moment. So I think if you look at matters through the lens of this statement, will become clear as I continue talking that archaeology will only illuminate the historical, social, and cultural setting of the Bible. That is what it can really do for us. It sometimes will give us a fact, an object which might have the name of a person or something of that nature, but in fact, it really provides the broad picture, the canvas on which the setting of the Bible narrative takes place. Secondly, it can't always illuminate, it can't always verify historical persons or events. And when you think about particularly the Old Testament, and it talks about individuals and what individuals did and where they went and so on and so forth, the relationships they had with each other, you know, these things just cannot be established necessarily through archaeology. If you find something that mentions a person's name, I mean, that's just like a needle in a haystack. But it cannot necessarily verify and cannot always verify historical persons or events. I mean, on excavations that I've been on, I've worked in Egypt for many years, there's lots of tombs with texts and so forth on them, but the actual dirt archaeology of digging a settlement site, so I've worked at the site of Memphis in Egypt, which was Egypt's capital for 3,000 years, and in terms of actual texts that we found, you know, maybe two scarab beetles with you know, a couple of hieroglyphs on them, and maybe a fragment of something with another text, and that was 6 weeks of excavation. The nature of these sites is such that the finding, especially settlement sites, the finding of textual material that might actually give you a name or shed something onto a historical event is very limited. And thirdly, the metaphysical story of the Bible cannot be illuminated by archaeology, and I think that's really goes without saying that you cannot actually do that with archaeological evidence. So just very briefly, I want to kind of, you know, step you through. Sometimes I feel like this. Certainly when I was on the end of that rope going down that tomb shaft was probably the closest I ever got to feeling like Indiana Jones. And it really was very exciting. I'm very grateful to Professor Kanawati for giving me that opportunity. But really, people think archaeology is like this. You know, it's all very romantic. It's full of mummies and coffins and whatnot. And look, you know, sometimes it absolutely is. But more often than not, it's like this. It's hard grind of recording, excavation with a trowel, planning, you know, really scientifically gathering your data. You know, scientists gather their data in all sorts of forms. You might gather it from a human body in forms of DNA. You might set up an experiment in a lab. archaeologists gather their data by just the hard yakka of getting in the field and digging it out. So, you know, for example, the far slide with me in the fluoride jacket, I'm actually doing a survey of a mining site. And those little stones, which don't look like very much from where you are actually the stations, the grinding stations where people, ground up the gold from the mountain behind them. And it was very hard to actually see what it looked like on the ground, but when you got a satellite photo and actually looked at it from a bird, you could see everything. It was amazing. But it is a very detailed and painstaking job. Now, it wasn't always like that, as I'll show you in just a moment. But archaeology, what is it? What is it? It's the study of ancient culture and society through its buildings and material culture. That is, pottery, objects, leftovers, people's rubbish dumps, human remains, the remains of people's food, any number of things. Whatever you put in your garbage bin every night is the stuff of archaeology, and that is true now as it was in ancient times, using empirical and scientific methods. So it's about collecting data, counting data, using scientific methods to analyse it, using microscience to understand the chemical composition of materials, how things were made, how things were woven, how things were put together, how things were fired. All of these sciences are used to kind of grab together and understand the material remains of the past. And it's not just, we think of tombs and temples as being the be-all and end-all of archaeological sites. Again, that's not so at all. There are so many types of archaeological sites. Basically, any man-made structure, be it, you know, a small wall that might have been made out of mud bricks to keep the sheep in at night, is an archaeological feature. And these sites, you know, there's numerous sites, cities, settlements, campsites, cave sites, cemeteries, religious sites, underwater sites, and of course there's been a massive explosion in underwater archaeology over the last 30 to 40 years. Quarries, mines, anything that has, any part of the landscape that has been affected by human action, really you can identify as an archaeological site. Of course, we think of the tombs and temples of Egypt, but in fact, the reality is that most sites are much more mundane than that. So how do we then look at this material particularly settlement material? I'm going to concentrate on settlement material because this is actually really where a lot of the complexity of archaeological debate occurs. I mean, in some ways, a tomb and a temple is much more straightforward, and particularly in Egypt, where you've got a built tomb and sand that fills in. I mean, some of the easiest archaeological sites I've ever excavated are in Egypt. But once you start getting into the Middle East, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, very complicated, particularly with large multi-phase settlement sites that have been occupied over a very, very long period of time. So here, for example, is a picture of a site, a tell, which is Arabic for mound, and it's like literally a mound, like a pimple sitting on a landscape, the remains of an ancient city, which has been the subject of an archaeological excavation. And it's the layer upon layer upon layer of excavating this sites like this. I mean, not every archaeological site looks like this. Obviously, the larger cities look like this. But it's the layer upon layer, as you see from the diagram, which the peeling back of that of those levels in a scientific, ordered scientific manner, which actually enables us to reconstruct the life and past societies, the life of people in past societies, in both a macro and a micro level. It's a very, very painstaking exercise and can take many, many years to achieve. So, for example, the picture of this site in Syria, you can see trenches on the top, trenches on the side. My guess is that probably represents 15 to 20 years' work, maybe even more. It's an expensive process and is one that cannot happen quickly. So it's work that doesn't happen quickly, and it is a it is something that takes, you know, you can spend 6 weeks in the field, and then you've generated enough material to keep you going for 2 years in the lab and the library. So it's you have to actually control the amount of, you can actually, in the past, you just send 100 workmen in and just dig the whole thing. But nowadays, in order to really understand it well, you've got to dig it very carefully and keep tight control of your scientific method. So the data looks like this. Really, this is the nuts and bolts of archaeological evidence. thousands of sherds of pottery. For pottery cultures, thousands, literally thousands of sherds. Bones, human bones, animal bones, seeds, fragments of objects that you may not even know what it is. You pick up a small object, might be the size of this pointer, but you know, I've looked at things and I've thought, I don't even know what that is, made of clay or whatever. So it's the analysis of this material, this kind of material, which and it's the putting together of the data in a coherent form, asking the research questions about it. What does it say about the past? What does it say about the individuals that made it? How were they buried? What technologies did they have? What peoples, what other cultures were they engaging with? I mean, one can actually ask all these kind of questions through archaeological evidence. And so actually then the question of, you know, what is the engagement with the Bible actually becomes just one of a subset of questions that you're asking of a meta data set like this. So, and here, you know, I cannot impress upon you how important, for example, ceramics, the study of ancient ceramics, are to our understanding of the past. I mean, just little bits of pottery like this are just so important. But, you know, 100 years ago, people didn't keep this. 19th century, archaeologists didn't keep this. They weren't interested. They were interested in complete vessels that they could put in a museum, but archaeological method has now changed so much that these kind of fragmentary bits of information can yield important clues as to about the past that all form the subject of inquiry. So, look, there are issues with archaeological data, issues with the use of archaeological data, both more broadly, whether you're doing research around the Bible or not. It is true that data is fragmentary and disjointed. There can be very uneven transmission of data over time. So there might be a large site that has, you know, maybe a multi-phase layer upon layer, which is missing the Late Bronze Age from the top of Jericho. We know it's there. We know it was there because there are some tombs which have Late Bronze Age material in it, and there's some ephemeral Late Bronze Age has been found, but the actual settlement of the Late Bronze Age is very meagre indeed. Very uneven transmission of the data. Again at Jericho, we saw on our most recent trip significant walls dated to the Middle Bronze Age. Middle Bronze Age around 1600 BC. Huge walls, but in fact the related settlement from the top of the tell is not there. When you're walking around the tell, you're straight on the Early Bronze Age from the time of the pyramids. The Middle Bronze Age settlement, we have the tombs and we have the walls, but the settlement isn't there. Again, very demonstrates the fragmentary nature, the disjointed nature, and the uneven transmission of data over time. And it's probably fair to say that, you know, pretty much every archaeological site has some hiatus in the transmission of the data. Conditions of preservation vary. So that's why we have, from Egypt, a huge number of fragments of papyrus from the desert which tell us about the early church. Fragments of the Gospels, fragments of the Gnostic Gospels, fragments of letters from Greco-Roman times. But you go to the coastal plain of Israel, where it's quite wet, you won't find very much papyrus there. But you go east into the Judean desert and you find the Dead Sea Scrolls. So just the conditions of preservation can actually dictate what is found, what is not found. The delta of Egypt, very wet. Groundwater is quite high, lots of tombs, even human, let alone papyrus, documents on papyrus, but even human remains struggle to be preserved in that sort of wet environment. Archaeology based on accurate observation and recording, not textual criticism or analysis. Now, that's not to say that if you find a text, you won't apply the kind of rules of textual criticism to it, but in fact, it's about observation and scientific analysis. Fair to say that in the 19th century and early 20th century, a lot of data has been lost. And you can imagine that the early explorers, when they realised that you could actually maybe dig a site and find evidence related to the Bible, they rushed to places like Jericho. They rushed to Gezer. They rushed to Megiddo. The Americans at Megiddo basically took the whole top of the tell off in the 1930s. And the later remains from Megiddo just aren't there. So, I mean, you know, a lot of the scientific method, archaeological method, was not very well developed. And so as a result, a lot of data was actually lost by early excavations. And one of the reasons why the Italians have gone back to Jericho is to try and unravel some of the problems that were generated by the work of previous excavators, and to try and unravel some of their issues that they weren't able to resolve. And as a result, it's clear that sometimes, and in fact sometimes often, the archaeology and the Bible text are not connecting. So I just want to briefly mention Flinders Petrie at Tel Hesse. This is quite an important excavation, not one that you'd have front of mind, but Petrie was very much a groundbreaking archaeologist and conducted probably what should be regarded as the first stratigraphic excavation in Palestine. So he dug at Tel Hesse, and as you see, which is in the south, and as you see, here's his drawing of a stratified, of how he excavated the site, which was groundbreaking for its time, but nowadays we would not excavate a site like that, we would do it quite differently. But, you know, certainly he set the groundwork for others that came later who then improved on his archaeological method. But he actually was the first to understand the importance of pottery in understanding the chronological phases of an archaeological site, particularly a settlement site where you've got no texts or very limited recourse to textual material. So, again, further problems. The archaeology of the Old Testament versus the archaeology of the New Testament. I think it's fair to say that the archaeology of the old v. the new is really, in a sense, it's a bit separate. There are a lot of problems around the archaeology of the Old Testament. So, sure, there's issues around the archaeology of the New Testament, and it's full of issues, but really a lot of the flashpoints around the current conversations do involve the archaeology of the Old Testament. And look, there's lots of different reasons for that. If in a multi-phase tell or city, the Old Testament is just deeper. You know, it's further down. You've got to dig deeper to get it. As you saw from that image of the tell that I showed you before, you can, these sites are significantly, they're big. You know, I've been in trenches where I've been at the bottom of 8 metres of vertical stratigraphy in a trench, and that's and I'm still not at the bottom. So it's much harder to excavate. Often the material from Old Testament times, I'm talking Bronze and Iron Age, can be made of mud brick, which is quite hard to excavate. Technically, they're much more complex. They cost a lot of money nowadays to put a team into the field. A big tell site, you wouldn't go into the field with a team of less than 20 to 30 people, which may not even include your specialists who are going to come in and blow in and look at the bones and the seeds and all that sort of thing. Whereas the New Testament, we're talking Greco-Roman times, often it's the Greco-Roman period that you've got to dig through before you get to the Old Testament. And as you see, I mean, look, this is a very broad generalisation, I have to say, but often it's sitting on the top, the Byzantine, the early Christian period, the Greco-Roman period, stone architecture. It's sitting on the top of everything else, and it's easier to see, it's easier to excavate, whereas the Old Testament is a lot more problematic. The Greco-Roman remains are relatively well preserved. I think it's also worth saying that for the Old Testament, we lack documents, particularly for the early periods. When I say early periods, there are fewer written documents for the external history of the region. In fact, the further back you go, the fewer documents there are. So for the early Bronze Age, and I'm talking about the period from around 3500, in fact, 3500 BC, we didn't even have writing in the Near East, down to about 2100 BC, there aren't a lot. For certain parts of the Near East, there are not written documents are a little bit thin on the ground. Of course, we have archives from places in Syria, but the land of Canaan, what we know as Canaan, that is Jordan and Israel, no texts. You find a text there, it's not going to come from there, it's going to be imported from somewhere else. And even the Middle Bronze Age, the land of Canaan does not appear to have been a literate society. And most of our records for those periods actually come from other regions. So, of course, with the spread of writing the quantity of inscriptions and texts outside the Bible increases, and as time goes on, the documentary record becomes more helpful. But for the Bronze Age and the early phases of the Iron Age, we're much more reliant on fragmentary archaeological data. So again, that comes back to that uneven transmission of the archaeological record that does not come to our aid. So just very briefly, it just summarises the situation in relation to the New Testament. We do have and I think it's fair to say that as a result of these issues, the archaeology of the period is relatively well understood. But, you know, there are still many issues that, that remain to be resolved. So let's just briefly talk about the roots of archaeological research. I just want to briefly set the scene here for this later discussion, and really as a way of illustrating that that archaeology itself is a relatively recent discipline. So we talk about modern developments in archaeology and the Bible record. The development of archaeology itself is a development, because it is still a very dynamic discipline to which the application of science continues to make groundbreaking discoveries. So, for example, the application of a number of new techniques to understand the ancient climate is still in its early stages. And so we can take all sorts of samples in the field to understand the impact of ancient climate changes. You know, 20 years ago, we couldn't do that. But nowadays, we can actually apply scientific method to different aspects of archaeological data sets and to the sites themselves to illustrate things that previously we were not able to see. We've already noted the work of Flinders Petrie, and really since then, 1890s, that's not so very long ago. That's not much more than, 125 years ago, Petrie was at Tallahassee. Since then, there's been a complete revolution in archaeological method and also archaeological thought, how we think about archaeological evidence and put it together in a framework of understanding the past. And the intersection of the Bible as part of that framework has also undergone quite a lot of change over time. So just think, the work of Petrie and his colleagues was very much set against the late 18th and 19th century backdrop of the development of science and emerging lines of inquiry such as evolutionary theories of Darwin, etc. And these things challenged the authority of the church and the traditional worldviews based on the Bible. And it's true, I think, in the 19th century that as these ancient cultures of the Eastern Mediterranean began to be rediscovered through their language and material culture, people began to realise that it might actually be possible to underpin the historicity of the Bible through archaeological evidence. So we had... You saw the big expeditions into Mesopotamia to bring back the sculptures. A lot of sculptures in the British Museum from Nineveh and so forth came into museums through this line of you couldn't even call it scientific. It wasn't scientific inquiry. It was really just looting of sites. But people got very excited by this because they could see the evidence from places that are mentioned in the Bible in their museums. There were exhibitions, lectures, establishment of learned societies, etc., with the express mission to illuminate the Bible through scholarly and archaeological inquiry. And Edward Robinson, who visited the Holy Land, was a key... You know, there's a number of key figures that helped kickstart this discipline. And it's fair to say that the translation of ancient languages, hieroglyphs, Akkadian, etc., really did start people really started to understand that, you know, the Bible just wasn't the be-all and end-all of what we understood about the region. So, for example, in the 19th century... We had the discovery of ancient texts and their decipherment, texts that had come into the British Museum. And here, lo and behold, is a Sumerian flood myth, which has very close parallels with the story of Noah in the Bible. Now, this was quite exciting, but also quite challenging to the way people thought about the Bible narrative. But people understood the importance of the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Canaanites, etc. And so these expeditions went in search of the kind of evidence that could underpin the Bible. But this is what an archaeological excavation looked like in the 19th century. You know, Layard ripping statues, not scientific at all. I mean, you hate to think how much data was actually lost, But that is the reality of it, and the museums of Europe are full of such objects. They were literate cultures with well-developed administrative and record-keeping systems, and the possibility of finding material that related to the Bible was obviously very high. So Egypt, of course, likewise, the same. People started to target Egypt, particularly the north, where people believed that the region of Goshen, mentioned in the Old Testament, was located where the Hebrews were. And so a number of expeditions in the eastern delta of Egypt endeavouring to try and find evidence of the Hebrews. But again, not very scientific. You can see here these pots, complete pots, which have been uncovered from a tomb, which would have found their way into a museum. But, you know, the micro data of sherds and so forth, completely lost. In fact, people didn't start keeping pottery sherds until maybe 50 or 60 years after this, systematically. I mean, some did, but many did not. So I think it's fair to say that, the Egypt Exploration Fund in the late 19th century, its aims were to organise expeditions to Egypt with a view to the elucidation of the history of and arts of ancient Egypt and the illustration of the Old Testament. So, you know, a real focus on trying to search for the real Bible in its historical context, but also there was an apologetic element to it as well. Let's find evidence that might prove the Bible. Now, during the 20th century, there was a shift. This is actually what a modern excavation looks like now, so very different to the kind of work that one was doing in Egypt in the 19th century. So a very big shift in the way that sites are excavated. Key person was William Foxwell Albright, and he went on to further refine archaeological method, a very key figure, and was somebody who had a very positivist view of the Bible and its relationship to archaeology. And he saw them very much coming together and was particularly interested in the role of archaeological evidence in the construction of biblical theory and history, particularly for the period of the patriarchs, the exile, and the return from Babylon. And he was also interested in the nature and antiquity of biblical law. So there's those of you that know something about ancient history will know that there's a lot of parallels between ancient laws of other cultures and what is in the Bible. But his work was very much set against a very intense debate about the Bible. And we're talking about particularly the period between the wars where he was very influential. On one side, there was biblical truth as inspired by God versus a more critical analysis, sometimes also known as the modernist approach, which really had very different approaches to archaeological evidence. One used the Bible to interpret archaeology, and the latter actually questioned the historicity of the Bible and saw ancient cultural developments as a natural progression in the development of humankind rather than the hand of God. And I think it's fair to say that one can see echoes of those two approaches in scholarship today. But Albright actually saw biblical archaeology as set within the wider framework of the archaeology and of Syria-Palestine. So he didn't just see the archaeology of Israel and the Bible as the be-all and end-all. And he could see, he was a gifted linguist, he understood the history of other cultures, and he could see that Israel and the Bible was operating within a wider cultural historical framework. He did, in fact, support the broad historicity of the Bible and asked biblical questions of his data. For example, could a certain destruction level, that is a layer of ash and burning in an archaeological site, be the destruction related to X mentioned in the Bible? So he was keen to sort of ask those questions. But very hard to ask those direct biblical questions when you're dealing with thousands of potsherds, you know, tiny, tiny layers of stratum in an archaeological site and dealing with evidence that doesn't actually yield historical facts. You know, how can you ask those questions of 10,000 potsherds? Very hard, and even he could see that from his archaeological excavations at a number of sites. And he and one of his students, George Ernest Wright, developed an approach which actually came to dominate thinking around the material culture of Palestine during the middle of the 20th century. And they generally saw archaeological data and its relationship to the Bible in a very positive light. And any data across the whole of the Near East was of interest. Now, there was a change after the war. There was a bit of a hiatus over a very long time, of course, but Kathleen Kenyon at Jericho really did start to revolutionise archaeological field method. She started working there in the early 1950s, and she built on the on work that she'd done in the UK, and used a new method of excavation which sought to record material in three-dimensional space using what we call horizontal and vertical stratigraphy. Now, if you want to know more about that, you can come to my Archaeology of the Bible course at Mary Andrews College and we can talk about that in more detail. But actually, this method really was to revolutionise, in very broad terms, the way archaeology was done in the Near East. You can see here, from her work here at Jericho, some of the deep trenches that she was able to excavate. You can see what I mean when I said before about, you know, how deep some of this is. And down the bottom here, she got to the pre-pottery Neolithic of Jericho around 8,000 BC, and there was a considerable depth of deposits just of that period alone. She worked there for a very long time, for a number of years. It was a very, very complex site, as I said. People still trying to unravel her work. But she was the one that actually exposed the fact, in a sense, that there was this lack of evidence for the Late Bronze Age, the period of the conquest at Jericho, and is still the period that's most commonly associated with the Exodus and the conquest. But in fact, what she did show was that this Jericho stretched back for many thousands of years. Now, her field method was further refined by others, and here's a slide of Jericho, which again shows you, you know, we're talking about mounds of rubbish, really, in terms of what a site looks like. But it's this kind of data that actually gives us the information that will enable us to intersect with the Late Bronze and the Iron Age and the Bible times. Her methods were refined. More excavations meant that the great antiquity of humanity was exposed. She herself did that at Jericho, but many other pre-biblical periods exposed by these archaeological excavations, Chalcolithic, Early Bronze, Neolithic, etc. And I think, you know, in terms of placing the Bible timeline on a historical chronological phasing of the region, we generally place the period of the patriarchs around the end of the third millennium, so sort of 2200 BC, around 2000 BC. But in fact, many of these sites go way, way back prior to the times of Abraham, who's generally placed around that time, the end of the third and beginning of the second millennium BC. And so, of course, this really challenged where the Bible sits in its historical, broader historical framework. And indeed, it became untenable to consider the archaeology of the Bible as self-contained and unrelated to anything else. So this was further developed by William Deaver, a scholar who, in fact, visited Sydney 3 years ago, and he was really, really a very influential scholar, probably the most influential archaeologist of the late 20th century, and he completely rejected and indeed attacked biblical archaeology's interpretive framework, preferring a scientific and anthropological approach based on the development of research questions and the testing of hypotheses. So he completely jettisoned the Bible as a lens through which one might read the Bible. Now, he's come back a bit, I think, from that. He's not quite as polemic around these spaces as he used to be. But for him, the Bible does not dictate the research questions, but it is part of the bigger picture of how we understand archaeology of the region. So I think it's fair to say that really since that time, scholars who brought a faith-based perspective or theological perspective were seen as bringing too much bias to their sites. One could actually argue the opposite, that if you come from a completely secular perspective, you're going to actually ignore the Bible as a source and bring a completely different viewpoint to the interpretation of your material. That, I think, is still a problem in the way that people regard archaeological data, especially around the flashpoints of the United Monarchy, the conquest, etc. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that it was true that many scholars recognised that one could not prove an act of God using archaeological data, and that archaeological evidence was often silent on many issues. And in addition to that, the application of science, radiocarbon dating and so forth, really did mean that a different paradigm was needed. So, in effect, the the connection, the historic connection between theology and archaeology has dissipated. And this old Albright right approach of biblical archaeology has gone. Deva was very much part of dissolving that relationship, although I said he still argues for the retention of the term biblical archaeology as a means of describing an ongoing dialogue between the two. Now, I think it's very interesting because when you think about what one brings to the analysis of human society, culture, and social processes, and I think that there is actually, there is and there must be room for a Christian hermeneutic around how we examine past societies. What behaviours have fueled why things were done? I mean, sure, we understand climate change and the impact of that and other issues of environment and so forth, but I think there is and must be a role for a Christian theoretical perspective which seeks to understand human behaviour as expressed in the archaeological record. And I'm not sure that there really is an adequate expression of that. And I think we need to move away from simply trying to find the connections between archaeological evidence and the Bible, or trying to explain what the differences are. You know, why? You know, there's some questions that we're never going to solve, certainly not in my lifetime. As I think I've already demonstrated, archaeological research is still an evolving discipline. We're still a long way from, you know, a bit like medical science, where this whole area of DNA and whatnot is starting to open up a vast new area of scientific research that we never thought was possible. I really think archaeology is in very much the same boat. So to be, you know, saying hard and fast that, oh, you know, we can't say this and there's no evidence for that. Well, you know what? I think that we're still in very early stages. But I think, too, that rather than simply jettisoning a Christian worldview, and we just have to move beyond this whole idea of just looking for those connections. You know, what is the Christian hermeneutic around understanding past societies? I think that is a really, as I've thought about this, that is, I think, a really interesting proposition. So I think that just to summarise some of the points that I've already made, we've moved away from attempting to prove the Bible with archaeology. Old and New Testaments now seen as a number of sources. Archaeology is a standalone discipline, but it's a multifaceted discipline with many different branches. Yes, I think more controversy over the Old Testament than the New. And I think we've also, as the discipline itself, has moved away from looking at how to explain culture and history to actually looking at social processes. What are the forces that make societies change? And in fact, that is, they're very interesting questions that archaeological data can actually tell us. So it's not just about what ideas did people have, what customs did they have, but what are the social processes? Climate change, of course, is the hot topic at the moment, and we understand a lot more about how that drove change in the ancient world than we did even 20 years ago. For me, this is a very useful, slightly more nuanced understanding of archaeology in the Bible, which I think is very helpful. Archaeological evidence is scattered, random, incomplete, just as the Bible's record is selective, ancient, and theologically oriented. There are perceived contradictions between the text and archaeological evidence, but also reasonable congruencies. And that is also true for the Old Testament. I've mentioned there are lots of problems, but there are also a number of connections. So very briefly, I just want to go through some of the couple of key flashpoints, just to give you a taste of what exactly this looks like at the moment in terms of where scholarship sits, and how this decoupling of the history of Israel as expressed in the Bible and as expressed in the archaeological evidence, where have we landed on? And there are some quite differing approaches and, in fact, differing interpretations of the archaeological evidence. And I think, you know, where we've landed on also is that you can have more than one interpretation of archaeological data. And if you've ever read any material related to any kind of archaeology, there's all lots of, oh, well, you know, probablys, possiblys, maybes. You can actually have, you know, three or four different conclusions from one body of data. So I think it's clear that we're at a situation with some of the flashpoints in the Old Testament. And look, these are around, particularly around the archaeology of early Israel. So the emergence of Israel as a nation the sort of post-conquest emergence of Israel in Palestine as an ethnic entity, and then the archaeology of the United Monarchy, that is Solomon and David, are particular flashpoints at the moment and highly controversial areas of scholarship, has rather morphed itself into a polemical discussion between what is called, on one hand, the biblical maximalists and the biblical minimalists. Now, the debate has moved on a bit from the use of those terms, but I think for the purposes of our discussions here, that's sort of two useful labels to adopt, that these are different perspectives on the historicity of various books of the Old Testament. As I mentioned, it's around the period of the Iron Age, the Judges and the United Monarchy. And the minimalists would actually question they actually don't even think that the text was written at that time. They see it as a creation of post-exilic priests or of exilic priests living in Babylon who've, you know, got time to kind of create a national narrative. And so they're reflecting stories from the past, from an oral tradition that is then created in a body of literature that is basically put together after the Israelites have been carried off into Babylon. And so they question the historicity of large parts of that pre-exilic biblical tradition. Whereas the maximalists would see the Bible as an important source for information about the early history of Israel, and they see it in that kind of almost, not quite in an Albright positivist light, but they certainly see it as in a more positive framework. So, this debate is quite detailed. When you get into the scholarly literature, it's about radiocarbon dates, it's about the pottery, it's about do we date this level to that or this level, when did that start, when did this start? So it's quite a, it goes backwards and forwards in the scholarly literature almost on a six-monthly basis. But it is an important one, and there's, it can get quite heated. So it starts with the, I mentioned the question of when did the Israelites appear in Palestine? Were they, did they arrive as a separate entity, as suggested by the Bible, or were they? Was it like a cultural evolution from the previous peoples of the Late Bronze Age into something a bit different that was influenced by the overarching political, cultural, and economic changes that were happening in the Eastern Mediterranean at the time? And so there are various positions around that. So we had the Philistines, we've got the Egyptianized Canaanite towns, and then you've got this large oval of other ethnic groups in the hill country of Israel, of what we know as Israel, which is really kind of where this new entity, which becomes the nation of Israel, starts to emerge. And how that happened, why it happened, did it happen, what it looks like archaeologically is a source of quite a lot of debate and is not a settled one. And indeed it involves things like trying to establish what does ethnicity look like in the archaeological record. You know, how does the pottery of one group of people, you know, you might have Chinese neighbours, does their rubbish look any different to yours? How do you actually establish that archaeologically? Is the architecture of the houses any different? Is the food they're eating any different? This is why, especially around food, you know, people eat different sorts of foods. Jews don't eat pork. A lot of attention is given to the animal bones on some of these sites to actually see whether there's any pork bones in them. I mean, I know that sounds a bit odd, but that's, you know, that it comes down to that kind of evidence. How do you actually identify archaeological ethnicity in the archaeological record? You could ask the same question about the Israelites, the Hebrews in Egypt. Who were the hill country settlers? Can we identify them as Israelites? What was the relationship with the Philistine? We've got this very strong Philistine material culture in the south, in the southwest of the country. What is the intersection with that? In relation to the United Monarchy, again, a major flashpoint. Some years ago, the biblical minimalist argued that David was purely a fictitious figure. Now, evidence has been discovered in more recent years which actually shows that to be not quite the case, but there's a lot of debate around whether the United Monarchy really was as it appears in the Bible. there's Israel Finkelstein, a very well-known Israeli scholar, is probably one of the most polemical scholars who are promoting this view that it basically didn't exist, it's all a fiction, there's no archaeological evidence for it. But actually, I'd like to argue that there are, again, emerging pieces of evidence which show that this picture we don't have quite enough to say, yes, there was a great temple. We don't have the temple from the first temple period, of course, but, you know, there is an emerging picture, a bit like a pixelated picture on a computer that's starting to become a little clearer. And here is really the first piece of evidence that poked a big hole in the David didn't exist argument, what's known as the Tel Dan Stela. A very important piece of evidence. It's a fragment of a stone inscription, which actually mentions Bet Daud, or House of David. And this was the first non-biblical reference to David that was ever found anywhere. And as you see, found quite relatively recently. You know, we're not talking about something found 100 years ago. Found in 1993, a season of excavations run by an institution, so not run by, you know, dilettante, media-hungry documentary makers, but actually proper archaeologists doing proper work, proper context, not something off the antiquities market. And this was a hugely controversial text when it was discovered, so much so that the biblical minimalist school, who was, you know, couldn't, you know, didn't want to have David a historical figure, actually accused the archaeologist of planting a forgery on his site. I mean, that's just extraordinary. Now, of course, that is a very extreme view, and there's a deal of scholarly consensus around this now, and there's not much debate about, you know, yes or no. Here we have this very good evidence for the House of David, the dynasty of David, as you like, mentioned in an ancient text. Another one of these flashpoints is around this disconnection between the grand picture of the United Monarchy as presented in the Bible, so 1 Kings 9, which talks about the Solomonic walls. I think I might have shown a slide before which actually has, I'll just go back to that, which actually shows this text. Here is the account of the forced labour King Solomon conscripted to build the Lord's temple, his own palace, the supporting terraces, the walls of Jerusalem and Hazor and Megiddo and Gezer, and of course the text goes on. And so what does that look like? Here we have, if you look at the square gates on the right-hand side, a series of similar gates at Gezer, Hazor, Megiddo, which date to the period of the 10th century, although I have to say the dating of this is people argue about it, but similar forms of monumental gateway, which speak of state-sponsored planning, the kind of architectural, civic architecture that one would see in as part of state-planned social civic architecture. So we are now finding, or not we, but scholars are now finding at a number of sites similar architecture. So here we have a more recent excavation, Kirbit Kaffa in southern Israel, where a fortified town, very tightly dated to a very short period of time, late 11th, 10th century, which at which a similar gate was found and exhibits similar features of this kind of civic planned architecture, which scholars identify as having been part of the planning of a civic authority, such as you might expect from the United Monarchy, from Jerusalem. In the words of one scholar, we have emerging the architectural features, fortifications, a standard gate, settlement processes, etc., demographic shifts, inscriptions, which actually start to speak of a state control of a territory that one might expect, that is spoken of in the Old Testament. And this six-chambered gate is actually an important part of, and it's also, six-chambered gates have been found at other sites as well, Jezreel, another one was found, and increasing excavations are starting to unearth these kind of materials. In addition to that, there is a very interesting text which was found at the same site. It's very hard to read. It's on a pottery fragment. Again, you know, you've got to look at your pottery because you might have a text written on it. In fact, I was in Egypt a couple of years ago excavating Coptic settlement, which was sitting on top of late period, you know, sort of 7th century remains, which was again on top of remains from the Egyptian New Kingdom, the time of Ramses II, and I was just kind of, you know, digging, and suddenly this, an ostracon, not as big as this, but with a Greek text, just fell in front of my feet. You know, it was about the size of a post-it note. It was extraordinary. I could see that the text was as clear as anything. It was so easy to read, although I don't read Greek, but I could see it very, very clearly. Here, this is a text where it's really, they needed to get infrared cameras to read this text. And it was found not, it was found during the pot washing. So the sherds of pottery just get put into a bucket, they're all dirty, and then they get washed. And lo and behold, once this is washed, it's got these, this fragmentary text on it, which is, again, it's quite controversial. There's a number of different readings of it. What does it say? It's hotly debated. It's thought to contain words in it like widow and judge, which are really only found in the Old Testament, documents of the Old Testament. What is important about this is that the question of transmission of the text of the Bible is a very important one in this debate. And so what this is suggesting is that there's a capacity for high-level literacy in the early Bronze Age that has hitherto not been attested. So it's a very small piece of the puzzle, and I really don't want to make too much of this except to say that it is a very important object, so I guess I am making a lot of it, but it's just the beginning of what is obviously a very long debate around this space of early literacy. Perhaps an important piece that speaks into this question of when did literacy emerge, and I mentioned before about the... when did the Bible emerge as a written text, rather? I mean, obviously, there was, you know, in the 7th and 8th century, we had, you know, literacy was emerging. But here we have dated to about 600 BC on paleography and associated ceramics, a text which actually preserves what the excavators say is the earliest known citations of text found in the Hebrew Bible, that is from Numbers 6, 24 to 26, that very famous text. Mentions Yahweh. And what's interesting about this, and what is actually so important about this, is that the archaeologists have dated it prior to the fall of Jerusalem and the captive of the Hebrews or the Israelites being carted off to Babylon in 586. They've actually dated it prior to that event. So it's so fragmentary. The reading appears to be quite clear. But it suggests a lost body of biblical material that is just, you know, very ephemeral in its expression in the archaeological record. Of course, I'll just finish here. Further emerging data around the interpretation of the city of David in Jerusalem, again very hotly contested. What is the? Can we date anything to this period? I think yes, we can. Step stone structure. Is late Bronze Age, but possibly Iron Age. Recent excavations are unearthing what the archaeologist who's excavating that site suggests might be the palatial residence of David, King David. There's a very early days in all of this, but there's clearly an emerging body of data there that is going to actually tell us. You know, we may have this picture in our head of Jerusalem being this magnificent, and certainly the Bible tells us of, you know, the cedar that was used in the temple and so forth. And I think, you know, there's a sense in which we kind of construct these images in our head of these grandiose places, but in fact the reality might have been relatively modest for the time, which has been, into which we read this grandiose statement of Solomon. But certainly the reality is yet to be found, but there's emerging evidence for it. I'm just going to go to, just conscious of the time, I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to talk about this, but actually here's my summing up. Way forward, new discipline, you can't prove the Bible with archaeology, a lot to be learned from the application of new scientific techniques, there's a lot to be done unravelling the past, excavations, don't engage with objects that have got no provenance, you know, the James Ostrey, these things that crop up, it's been in someone's basement for 10, 20 years, nobody knows where it was found. Honestly, you waste a lot of hot air trying to unravel those pieces. Better off engaging with, you know, proper excavations. New discoveries can change the picture overnight. See the Bible as part of the bigger picture. Recognise that cultural change is driven by a range of factors. And as I said earlier, I think there is a need for a Christian hermeneutic which can be applied to explain the ancient past. And that, I think, is something that I'm certainly going to give a little bit more thought to in the coming years. Thank you.